Devi and friends, before I start the subject for this morning, I would just like to say something about the meditation which we had this morning and the meditation which we are going to have tomorrow and day after also. In this meditation, you must have noticed, those of you who were present, that we are following a technique of visualization. This technique was given in Buddhism and was also given in Hinduism. In Hinduism, in Kashmir Shaivism, you find this technique given, the technique of Kriya Shakti, the creative power of thought. In Buddhism, it is known as Vajrayana. In Buddhism, we are familiar with Hinayana and Mahayana. But the last of the discourses which the Lord Buddha gave centered around the principle of Vajrayana. And this Vajrayana also deals with the technique of visualization. This visualization does many things. It enables us to generate more energy in the body and the mind, in the whole being. It helps us to deal with our various ailments and illnesses very effectively. In fact, today medical science is experimenting with visualization to treat cancer cases. And they have succeeded to a very large extent. Not the terminal case of cancer, but cancer which is detected earlier, and it can be detected now earlier. This visualization technique is more and more being used. This visualization enables us to control the flow of time. And this visualization, among other things, helps us to move along the path of concentration and meditation. It is because of this that we are using this visualization technique for our meditation every morning. We did this today, we will do tomorrow, and we will do day after, just to have an idea as to what this meditation can be under the orientation of visualization. This morning's subject is the occultist and the mystic. It sounds very philosophical, it sounds very abstract, but I'm not going to deal with this subject in philosophical abstractions, nor in terms of intellectual speculation. I want to deal with this subject in a very practical manner, because this subject has great relevance to our day-to-day life. In fact, if we do not understand the occult and the mystic and the principles underlying these phenomena, perhaps we will not be able to deal effectively with the problems with which we are confronted in our daily life. What is our problem of daily life? Our main problem of daily life is how to translate what we believe in our daily action. We always say that we must try to translate all this. We must live it. We must bring our precepts and beliefs into daily action. And yet this is our main difficulty. In the Bhagavad Gita, where you find the illuminating dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna, the pupil, Arjuna says at one place to the Lord, he says, "Lord, sometimes you praise action, and sometimes you praise knowledge. Is knowledge superior to action, or is action superior to knowledge? Please tell me in clear terms. Then the Lord says to Arjuna at that place in the Bhagavad Gita, and what he says is most illuminating and at the same time most startling. He says, those who regard knowledge and action as separate are immature, devoid of understanding. And yet for most of us, knowledge and action are different. How is it? And what is the validity of the statement of the Bhagavad Gita that between knowledge and action there is no difference whatsoever? Knowledge is action, but that is not our experience. Why? Let us find out what is knowledge. What is it that we call knowledge? What is our knowledge? Our knowledge is mere information. We have gathered much information along many lines about many subjects, but it is nothing more than information. Or, in other words, what we call knowledge is our belief. We believe in certain things. We believe in spiritual life. We believe in certain ideals. We believe in the spiritual perspectives. We believe in many, many things. And we want to translate belief into behavior. But may I say that this is impossible. We may go on for hundreds of years and yet we will not be able to translate belief into behavior. Why? Because belief is something static. You call it principle, you call it ideal, you call it by whatever name you like. It is something that is static. Whereas behavior is concerned with life. And life is tremendously dynamic. How can a bridge be constructed between two points where one point is static and the other point is all the time moving in a state of dynamism? It is impossible to construct such a bridge because even if we construct it, it will collapse because such a bridge can never exist between a point that is static and a point that is intensely dynamic. Then what is meant by the statement in the Bhagavad Gita to which I have just now referred, that those who regard knowledge and action as separate are immature, devoid of true understanding? If no bridge can be constructed between belief and behavior, and it is true that we can't. If we come to perception and practice, then no bridge is necessary. The perception immediately translates itself into practice. Since what we call knowledge is not perception, it is belief, it is impossible to translate belief into behavior. But when we come to perception, then there is no problem of translation at all. The perception spontaneously, effortlessly, immediately translates itself into action or into practice. We must go into this question of perception because there is no doubt that in life we have to act constantly from moment to moment. As once again the Bhagavad Gita says, not even for one moment can man remain without action. Since we have to act, we must know how to act rightly. But in order to come to right action, what is of fundamental importance is right perception. Right perception translates itself into right action. There is a beautiful incident quoted in Sufism. One pupil went to the master, a woman teacher, Rabia, a great mystic in the Sufi tradition. And this young man, the disciple, said to Rabia, Rabia, I have been knocking at the door of reality for quite some time. But nothing happens. The door does not open at all. Then Rabia said to the young man, that you may go on knocking at the door of reality for 1,000 years, but the door will not open. And the young man said, why? Why will not the door open? Is there anything wrong so far as the knocking is concerned? Why will it not open? And Rabia said, yes, even if you go on knocking at the door for 1,000 years, the door will not open for the simple reason that the door has never been closed. For the simple reason that the door has never been closed. Now, this is the problem of right perception. That which is open, we are unable to see it as open. There is some defect so far as our perception is concerned, and therefore it is of the utmost importance that we must go into the subject of right perception. Both occultism and mysticism are concerned with this problem of perception. But before we go into the occult and the mystical aspects of perception, let us see what our normal perception is. How do we perceive? What is the first grade of perception to which we have become familiar? The first grade of perception, obviously, is the sensorial perception. We perceive through our senses. We say we have 5 senses. But the scientists tell us, no, we have 20 senses. We don't know what the other 15 senses are, but the 5 senses are good enough so far as our daily living is concerned. We perceive through this instrument of senses. But we all of us know that our senses are limited so far as the range of perception is concerned. We had a great scientist in India, Dr. Sir C.V. Raman, a Nobel Prize winner, and he specialized in light and color. He says at one place that between 2 colors of the spectrum, remember not the whole spectrum, but between 2 colors of spectrum, there are no less than 250 different shades of color. But we don't know. Our eyes can respond only to certain vibrations of color. There are many, many vibrations above and below to which our eye is not able to respond. The eye, even though it is sensitive, has its limitations, and therefore whatever the eye perceives is something that is limited, because there is much which is outside its range. The same is with regard to the ear. There are so many octaves of sound, but the human ear is able to respond only to certain octaves. There are octaves above, there are octaves below. There are birds that sing with such shrill pitch that our human ear is not able to respond. We are not even aware of that sound which is emitted by a bird. In other words, just as the eyes, similarly the ears, they are limited in the range of perception, and therefore we are first of all concerned with our sensorial perception. It is true that the range of the senses can be extended. There are processes by which one can do it. In the Montessori system of education, for example, Madame Montessori is concerned with this sensorial response, and she indicates the ways by which the sensorial responses can be increased. Nevertheless, the first grade of our perception is the sensorial perception. If we say that I am prepared to accept only that which my senses bring, then surely our perception is defective. Because there is so much in this universe which our senses are not able to pick up, And yet those things certainly exist. Sensorial perception is the first perception. Then we come to the second grade of perception, which is the scientific grade of perception. Science is concerned, as we know, in breaking down to a certain extent the limitations of sensorial perception. The telescope, the microscope, the radio telescope, and we saw certain pictures last night, beautiful pictures of the atom and of the cosmos. There is so much which our eyes cannot see, and yet such scientific instruments as microscope and telescope and many sophisticated instruments of modern science can bring us information about this universe with regard to which we are completely unaware. Science is all the time concerned with breaking down. In other words, it is concerned with the extension of the range of sensorial perception. It is all the time extending the range of sensorial perception. That is what science is concerned with. And today, science is moving with such rapid strides that if we only regard science in terms of what it was during the 19th century, then we are completely outdated. Science today is no longer materialistic. To say that science is materialistic is completely wrong. In fact, science is at present knocking the doors of spirituality. Modern science, and particularly modern physics, has come almost to the threshold of spirituality. It has not entered because it cannot move further, but it has come to recognize that matter does not exist, that the existence of matter is something which we have to rule out, because it is consciousness which is the basic stuff of this universe. In the 19th century, scientists were very much concerned with matter and mind. A young man went to a learned professor and said to the learned professor, "Sir, tell me, what is matter?" And the learned professor said, "Never mind." The young man said, "Sir, tell me what mind is." And the learned professor said, "It does not matter." This is the conversation which is quite known so far as the 19th century science was concerned. They were concerned about mind and matter. And there is the statement of Professor Tyndall, who was the president of the prestigious organization, the Institution for the Advancement of Science, which exists today in Britain, in America. Professor Tyndall, who was the president of this association, in 1861, he said from his presidential chair, and this was the statement that he made, that in matter lies the promise and potency of every form of life. In other words, he said, you can find out life by studying matter, because matter contains life. Life is only a particular permutation and combination so far as the physical atoms are concerned. But that is not the case today. Science has moved away from that position. Today, science is concerned about the supremacy of mind over matter. This is what physics is talking about. And therefore, physics tells us that it is consciousness which is the basic stuff, not matter. Because the scientists tell us, the more we analyze, the more we go into it, we come to a point where we are unable to see anything whatsoever. We see void, and they call this void the dynamic void. That is where modern science seems to have come. For example, if you see to the writings of David Bohm, who speaks about the wholeness, he is the one scientist who has spoken about wholeness. But we must understand, and this is where we seem to be a little bit confused, that wholeness and totality are not identical. Totality is the sum of the parts. But as David Bohm himself says, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And therefore, it is not totality that he speaks of. He is speaking of wholeness. And therefore, you will find in modern scientific investigation much about which we had read in the old books of religion and philosophy. For example, you find one story in one of the Upanishads. A young man returned after 12 years of learning at the feet of the master. When he returned, the father welcomed him. And the father asked the son, "Son, what have you learned during all these 12 years? And the son said, "Father, I have learned many sciences, many arts." And he gave a long list of the sciences and the arts that he had learned. Then the father said, "But have you learned that by learning which nothing else needs to be learned?" The son said, "Father, no, I have not learned it. Probably my teacher himself did not know that there is such a branch of learning." Then the father said, "All right, I will give you that instruction." He said, "There is a banyan tree, and there are any number of fruits of the banyan tree lying on the ground. Just pick up one fruit and bring it to me." And the son took that fruit to the father. The father said, "Break it." And the son broke it. And the father said, "What do you see?" And the son said, "Father, I see countless tiny seeds." The father said, "Very well, take up one seed, one tiny seed, and break it." Son broke it. The father said, "What do you see?" The son said, "Father, I do not see anything at all. I see nothing." Then the father said, "That which you call nothing has been the cause of this giant banyan tree. That which you call nothing has brought this giant banyan tree into existence. Thou art that. You are that. That which you call the void, that is what you are. Out of the void, entire life has come into existence." In the Upanishads, they spoke about this void. And they said, wisdom demands the exploration of this void. But today, modern science is beginning to talk about void. And therefore, as I said, science is no longer materialistic. It is struggling to understand something that the spiritual science has talked about for ages and ages. In any case, the second grade of perception is the scientific grade of perception, where science is trying to break down the limitations of the sensorial range and bringing larger and larger universe before us. But even then, this effort of science has its limitations because it can deal with physical phenomena. It cannot deal with something which is beyond the physical. And therefore, just as the sensorial perception has its limits, the scientific perception also has its limits in as much as it is dealing with something that is physical. Although it has taken note of something that transcends the physical, science has no means to understand, no instrument by which to probe the deep realities of that which is beyond the physical. We come here to the third grade of perception. The third grade of perception is the psychic perception. The psychic perception about which we used to read in the literature of the last century, and even now we read about it. This psychic perception is a mediumistic perception, so that there are certain superphysical entities that can use us as instruments, that can bring us information and pass on that information to the human consciousness. The psychic phenomenon is by and large a mediumistic phenomena. And there is a vast literature on this mediumistic perception in the East as well as in the West. You find large number of books written on this particular subject. In fact, it is becoming one of the subjects of investigation under extrasensory perception. The extrasensory perception speaks about clairvoyance, about clairaudience, about retrocognition, about precognition, about hypnosis, about psychometry, about bilocation. There are so many subjects that are being discussed today under extrasensory perception. But here, while the extrasensory perception science is dealing with these superphysical perceptions, it does not know what is the modus operandi so far as coming to this particular extrasensory perception is concerned. They have noted that there are things which are found through extrasensory perception, but they do not know how to do it, how to awaken these powers. They have noted the powers, but today the extrasensory perception literature is unable to tell us how to go about in order to awaken these superphysical perceptions. The sensorial perception, one grade. The scientific perception, the second grade. The psychic perception, the third grade. We come to the fourth grade of perception. And the fourth grade of perception is the occult perception. The occult perception is not dependent upon the mediumistic agency. The occult perception is a self-initiated perception. And the yoga systems in India have spoken about it, have written about it. This is something which is quite common so far as certain yoga disciplines are concerned. In fact, in the ancient yoga systems of the Hindus, it was known that there are 8 siddhis, 8 accomplishments, 8 superphysical accomplishments, and these were of a diverse nature. A man could make his body so light that he can fly in air. We had, till now, this problem facing modern science. How to surmount the pull of gravity? Is it possible for us to surmount the problem of gravity? And modern science, to a certain extent, has been able to solve it. But the ancient yoga systems solved it ages ago, that there is the possibility for man to make his body so light that he can float in air, or he can make so heavy that it cannot be lifted up. There are the cases in Hindu mythology of that great figure Hanuman, who is unfortunately known as Monkey King. He was not a monkey king. He was a great yogi, and he had those powers. When occasion arose, he could make his body so heavy, even his tail so heavy, that nobody could lift even the tail. This is one of the accomplishments about which you read in occult siddhis. Or there are various other occult powers which did not depend upon the instrumentation with which modern science is concerned. But it was possible for man, through the development of occult powers, to come in possession of these accomplishments. This is what is known as occult. It is possible. Now, let us try to understand what we mean by occult. Occultism is a science. It is a veritable science, a science that was mastered particularly in ancient India. But what is this science about? Just as the physical science is concerned with understanding the visible phenomenon, the phenomenon that is visible to us, the phenomenon that can be cognized by our senses, that is with which modern science is concerned. And modern science has moved a great deal in understanding the science of the visible. But occultism is also a science. It is a science of the invisible. Because this universe has visible aspects, it has invisible aspects. Modern science has recognized the invisible aspect of the universe, but is not in a position to understand how the invisible phenomena. In fact, that was the basis of Madame Blavatsky's Isis Unveiled and Madame Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine. Madame Blavatsky, in the last century, was fighting single-handed, relentlessly fighting the impact of the science of those days. And she said to the scientists of the 19th century, she said, there are more things in heaven and on earth than are thought of in your philosophy. There are more things in heaven and on earth about which you do not know at all, because the 19th century science did not take into account the existence of something that is invisible. That means something that is outside the range of the physical senses. It took note of only those things which could be cognized through the instrument of senses. And therefore, science has moved today. Science is prepared to recognize the existence of the invisible. Nobody has seen an electron. Nobody has seen even an atom. In fact, as Professor Einstein says at one place, this is what he says, that we do not know what electricity is. This is the statement made by him. Nobody knows what electricity is. We only know how electricity behaves. That is what modern science is doing. They know the behavior of an electron on their graphs, but nobody has seen an electron. Nobody has seen an atom, and therefore they recognize the existence of certain things which are outside the purview of the sensorial visibility, and yet they do not know how to come to the understanding face to face with that particular thing. There is today a great discussion that is going on about the quarks. And it is said that the quarks represent the ultimate matter. It is doubtful. Because first of all, nobody has seen a quark. Not only that, the quarks are never to be found in single existence. They are joint and you cannot separate it. And therefore, once again, the scientists are only talking of the behavior of something, but are not able to see it face to face because of the inability of modern science to delve into these aspects of the invisible universe. Nevertheless, we have to recognize that the universe does not exist merely at the visible level. It certainly exists at the invisible level also. And so the visible universe and the invisible universe. But that is not all. The universe does not exist merely at the visible or at the invisible level. There is the third layer of existence so far as the universe is concerned. And that third layer is neither visible nor invisible, but intangible. The intangible universe. That which cannot be cognized by the senses, that which cannot be cognized by the possession of the superphysical powers, but that which still exists and exists very much and plays a very important part in our daily life, and that is the intangible universe. Beauty, love, truth, goodness, they are our experiences, real experiences. But they are not the experiences that are tangible. You cannot hold it. It is something which is beyond tangibility. You know, in one of the Upanishads, there is a discussion going on between the pupil and the teacher. And the teacher says to the pupil that whatever you can gather from outside is only lower wisdom. It is called the apara vidya in the language of the Upanishads. It is something lower. It is only knowledge. Even if you find knowledge through the reading of the Vedas, even that is a lower knowledge. That is what this particular Upanishad says. Then the pupil says to the master, "Master, what is this wisdom? What is this paravidya? What is this higher knowledge?" And the teacher gives a description. He says, "You cannot find it from outside. I'm only giving you a description because it can't be defined. But I'm giving you a description of that higher knowledge, that wisdom, that theosophy, because theosophy is divine wisdom, it is not divine knowledge. And what are the characteristics of this divine wisdom?" And the teacher says, "There are four characteristics of divine wisdom. By those four characteristics, you can know that you have come to something that transcends the realm of knowledge." What are these four characteristics? The four characteristics given in the Upanishads in the Sanskrit language are, first of all, it is agotra. In other words, it is timeless. It has no past. It has no future. It is timeless, agotra. Then the second characteristic that is given by the teacher in the Upanishad is, it is achintya. It is beyond the process of thinking. You cannot find it by thought process. However much you may carry on your thinking process, you cannot find it. Thirdly, he says it is aprameya. Aprameya means immeasurable. You cannot measure it. You find, for example, in that beautiful book of Edwin Arnold, Light of Asia, while dealing with the phenomenon of nirvana, this poet says in one exquisite line, he says, "Measure not with words the immeasurable." Don't measure with words the immeasurable. This wisdom, this theosophy, this Brahma Vidya, this higher knowledge is timeless, it is beyond thought, it is immeasurable. And fourthly, the teacher says to the guru, it is intangible. You can't hold it. You can't hold it in your hands. You can't hold it in your mind. And yet it exists. Something that exists, you can experience it, but you cannot possess it. This is the intangibility about which the Upanishads speak. And it is this intangibility which is the nature of the universe, not merely visible, not merely invisible, but visible, invisible, and intangible. Now, I am coming to this because occultism, while it is concerned with the invisible universe, it has not yet come to the understanding of the intangible. Intangible is outside the purview of occultism. Occultism is concerned with exploring the invisible, more and more into the invisible realms, but not that which is intangible. Occultism is the science of the invisible. And in modern theosophy, we have done much to explore the science of the invisible. Magnificent literature, Secret Doctrine, Isis Unveiled, and the later books that have come, they all deal with the theosophy of the invisible. There is the visible that we know, But theosophy, modern theosophy, has been concerned with the exploration of this invisible. And we find much illuminating literature in the vast number of theosophical books. But to me, it seems, we have come in the course of our theosophical work, after one century of the existence of the Theosophical Society, we have come to that point when we should be able to explore the theosophy of the intangible, not merely the theosophy of the invisible. Theosophy of the invisible is concerned with occultism. Theosophy of the intangible is concerned with mysticism. For example, you will find in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, the great exponent of the yoga system, he says at one place, after describing all these eightfold superphysical powers, the eightfold occult powers, while discussing that, at the end of that discussion, there is one tiny sutra, aphorism, in the Patanjali Yoga Sutra. The Sanskrit sutra says, Pratibhad va sarvam. He says that you can come to all this without the development of occult powers. You can come to all this by the development of the mystic or the spiritual insight. Pratibha is the spiritual insight. By spiritual insight, you can come to all this, which is the part of the study of the invisible universe. In other words, this is what is indicated in mysticism. I'm sure many of you have read that fascinating book, Light on the Path. The Light on the Path contains many, many illuminating and inspiring statements. As you come towards the end of Light on the Path, there is one statement which says, hold fast to that which has neither existence nor substance. Hold fast to that which has neither existence nor substance. How can you do it? In terms of occultism, there is no answer to it. You can't understand it. Because that which has no substance, which has no existence, how can you hold fast to it? Here, the Light on the Path is speaking about something that is intangible. It says further on, listen to the voice that is soundless. Look only to that which is invisible, both to the outer as well as the inner sense. Now these are the statements that you find in Light on the Path. And these are the statements which cannot be understood in terms of the science of occultism. In terms of the science of the invisible, we have to explore the science of the intangible. It is the intangible which is the whole. It is the intangible which contains the meaning and the purpose of life itself. The tangible, whether visible or invisible, the tangible is only a partial expression of that which is the whole. Since very much we are talking of the holistic approach, we are talking more and more of the wholeness, I suggest that it is not possible to understand this wholeness either in terms of modern science or in terms of the science of the invisible, which occultism is. This can be understood only in terms of mysticism, beauty, truth, the livingness of life itself, goodness, love. These are not subjects which can be understood either through the visible or the invisible sciences. They need a movement completely different. It is a dimensional movement, and that dimensional movement is the movement from the visible and the invisible to something that is supremely intangible. I would like to say, although this subject itself is so large and fascinating, and I'm talking of the timeless in the context of time, and therefore I have to look to the watch. I'm limited by time, But within the limitation of time, I am placing before you something that denotes timelessness. Time and timelessness, these have to be understood. We have taken as our theme for this International Week the true values of life. The true values of life are not manufactured by the mind. It is not an intellectual process. It is not the formulation of a belief or a formulation of an intellectual principle. It is concerned with perception. It is concerned with right perception. We cannot come to the true values of life unless and until we have come to the right perception of things. And what is right perception? If you turn, for example, to some of the books of modern scientists, take, for example, Capra, his book, The Tao of Physics, or his book, The Turning Point, or many other of these scientists, modern scientific writers. They give us one idea. You will find this idea repeated in book after book. They say, this is what Capra says in his Tao of Physics. He says, in every act of observation, the observer is involved. In every act of observation, the observer is involved. In other words, you cannot observe because the observer is all the time modifying the object of perception, the object of observation. This is what modern physics tells us. This is what Patanjali said ages ago. Patanjali says in his Patanjali Yoga Sutra, with which some of you are familiar, in the Patanjali Yoga Sutra, Patanjali says that it is possible to keep away the suffering which has not come. The suffering which has not come can be avoided. That is what Patanjali says. And naturally, we would be happy if that could be possible, that the suffering that has not come can be avoided. Because the suffering that has come, we will somehow adjust ourselves. But if we can get the promise that the future suffering can be avoided, then obviously we would be happy. But before we can go into the enjoyment of that happiness, Patanjali gives immediately another aphorism next to it, immediately. He says, what is the cause of human suffering? Why does man suffer? Why does man come to the experience of pain and sorrow? And he gives an explanation in that sutra where he says, it is the observer-observed phenomenon which is the cause of man's suffering. The observer-observed phenomenon. In other words, we live not in the actual world. We have not seen what the world as it is. The world of human relationships, the world of objects, the world of ideas, whatever it may be. We have not seen the actual world. We live in the observed world. In other words, we live in the world which has been created by our mind. We see what we want to see. We see things that don't exist at all. It is because we live in the observer-observed phenomenon. We do not see what is actual. We see only that which is observed. In Hindu philosophy, one illustration is again and again given. That illustration is of the rope and the snake. There is something lying there. And I say, oh, it's a snake. I won't go near it. I'm afraid to go near it. And I tell people, don't go near it because there is a snake. But some wise man says, look here, this is not a snake, it is a rope. I say, how can it be rope? I see with my own eyes that it is a snake. I see with my own eyes. This is what is discussed in Hindu philosophy. One of the modern scientists very beautifully says that it is not the eye that sees, it is the mind that sees. The eye does not see because whatever is perceived is immediately interpreted by the mind. And therefore we live in the world of mind's interpretation, in the world that is created by the mind. That is the observed world. And Patanjali says, we suffer because we live in an observed universe. We live in the universe which is created by the observer himself. Modern scientist says, we are confronted with this problem because the observer all the time modifies. How to get rid of the observer? There is no answer in terms of modern science. There is no answer in terms of occultism. The answer comes only through mysticism, where mysticism is concerned with the removal of the observer himself. Because there cannot be right perception so long as the perceiver exists. Because the perceiver all the time modifies the object of perception. And therefore the right perception is possible only where there is no perceiver nor the perceived, no observer nor the observed. That alone is the right perception. And it is only out of that right perception that right action can come into existence. Because the mind is biased. The mind is motivated by its enormous storehouse of memory. The mind perceives only through likes and dislikes. The mind perceives only through rejections and acceptances. The mind is not able to give us a perception of the thing as it is. And therefore, the perception, whether it is of science, whether it is of the senses, or whether it is of occultism, that perception is a dual perception. It is the perception in terms of duality, the observer and the observed. It is only when we come to the mystic perception, the perception through mysticism, that we have transcended the realm of duality and we are able to come to the non-dual experience where there is neither the perceiver nor the perceived, neither the observer nor the observed. It is the non-dual perception. And the non-dual perception alone is the right perception because there is no observer modifying the object of observation. Love, the experience of love, is the experience of non-duality. In duality, there is no experience of love whatsoever. It's a non-dual experience. And therefore, it is rightly said that love is not blind. Love sees more. Love sees more. That is the right understanding of love. It is to this that Madame Blavatsky draws our attention. In the very beginning of the Voice of the Silence, there is a beautiful statement. I regard the Voice of the Silence of Madame Blavatsky as the yoga of theosophy. She has given in the Voice of the Silence 313 sutras or aphorisms. We tend to study the Patanjali aphorisms, but we have not cared to go to the aphorisms of Madame Blavatsky as contained in the Voice of the Silence. In the Voice of the Silence, you find one beautiful aphorism, sutra of Madame Blavatsky. It says, right perception of existing things, the knowledge of the non-existent. The right perception of existing things, the knowledge of the non-existent. If we can rightly perceive the existent things. What is meant by right perception? The right perception of existing thing means there is neither the perceiver nor the perceived. Who is the perceiver? The perceiver is the human mind. The mind is the perceiver. Patanjali once again in his Yoga Sutra says that mind has been made into an instrument of perception. The mind has no business to become the perceiver. The mind is an instrument of action, but it is not the instrument of perception. But we go all the time with the perception given to us by the mind. These are our values, and therefore they are not true values. It is only when the mind is silent, the perceiver is silent. It is only in the silence of the perceiver that there comes right perception, because that is a perception where there is no observer interfering with the act of perception whatsoever. There is neither the observer nor the observed. That is the right perception. And when there is the right perception of existing things, Madame Blavatsky says, there comes the knowledge of the non-existent, the knowledge of the non-existent, the knowledge of the unmanifest, the knowledge of the intangible, the knowledge that has not yet come into the manifested universe, the knowledge of the whole, because it is the non-existent which is the whole. The existent is part. This that we call the manifested universe is a part. And therefore it is only in the intangible that it is possible for us to find the solutions of the tangible universe. If you go to the Bhagavad Gita is a supreme book, universal scripture, not belonging to any particular religion, to any particular race, to any particular country, or to any particular age. It is a universal scripture. There are two discourses in the Bhagavad Gita, the 10th discourse and the 11th discourse. If you go to the 11th discourse, the 11th discourse is concerned with the occult phenomena. It is concerned with the perception of that which is invisible. That is the subject matter of the 11th discourse, where Arjuna, the great disciple, says to the Lord, Lord, I want to see your universal form. And the Lord says, very well, I will show you my universal form. But you can't see my universal form with these eyes. And therefore, I will endow you with a superphysical perception, occult perception, so that you can see my universal form. And Arjuna sees, and he's frightened. He said, Lord, I don't want to see further. Please come back to your original form. I don't want to see it. This is the vision of the invisible, the occult vision that is given in the 11th discourse. But come to the 10th discourse. The 10th discourse is the discourse which is concerned with the vision of the glories and the splendors of the divine. And there the Lord says, my glories are all over the world, in everything that you will find. There is nothing where you do not find my glories. There is nothing where you do not find my splendors. And there is the beautiful description. The whole description in the 10th discourse is the description of the intangible, even as the whole description in the 11th discourse is the description of the invisible. It's intangible. So much so that the Lord goes even to that extent of saying, I am the gambling of the cheat. He doesn't say, I am cheat. He says, I am the gambling of the cheat, the spirit of adventure that motivates the cheat. I am that spirit of adventure. You will find all over. For example, he says, I am not the Himalayas, but I am the steadiness of the Himalayas. You will find these beautiful descriptions, the Vibhuti Yoga, as the Bhagavad Gita speaks. There you find this intangible. One, the invisible, the other, the intangible. The one concerned with the occult perception, the second concern with the mystic perception, the mystical perception where there is no duality of the perceiver and the perceived. It is a non-dual perception. And when there comes this non-dual perception, then there is no problem so far as practice is concerned. Where there is perception, practice immediately follows. Then we don't have to discuss the problem, how to translate in my behavior what I believe. Because between belief and behavior, there is a gulf which cannot be bridged, which can never be bridged. But there is no gulf between perception and practice. The moment I perceive, it gets translated. Such is the power of that perception that it automatically, spontaneously translates itself into action. And so our problem of daily life, how to translate what we know into action. We do not know. If we know, then we would agree with the Bhagavad Gita that he who regards knowledge and action as separate are people without understanding. They are immature. They do not know what the true facts are. If we want to understand the real meaning of this, then we must come to the right perception. Not merely the sensorial perception, not merely the scientific, not merely the psychic, not even merely the occult, but we must come to this mystical perception, the perception of non-duality, because then we will be able to say with Madame Blavatsky, right perception of existing things, the knowledge of the non-existent. This is occultism, this is mysticism, and I suggest the time has come when we, the students of theosophy, must move more and more into the investigation of the unexplained phenomenon about which the Theosophical Society speaks. It is unexplained because the mind can never explain it. Its explanation comes. It is not the result of mentation. And therefore I suggest that in the new century of the Theosophical Society, you and I, students of theosophy, must move more and more into the realms of mysticism so that we can come to the right perception of things. And when there is right perception, there is no problem of practice whatsoever. You and I will be able to translate that which we know, because then our knowledge will not be just information, but the knowledge will be our experience. Where there is experience, there is no problem of expression. Experience translates itself into expression.